And now it's time for KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for listening to your radio and for joining us on Twitter at KUOW. This 4th of July is a special one in Seattle. Besides the whole Birth of a Nation thing, tomorrow also marks 100 years of the Ballard Locks. And if all you know of the locks is the fish ladder and the boats, I invite you to stay tuned and come to understand how this cut from the lake to the sound has changed people's lives in a way they still deeply feel today. We're going to take you there in about 10 minutes or so. But first, our top story today is that it has been 5 years since the Washington Supreme Court ruled that our state was not fully funding education. You've heard that ruling called McCleary, named after one of the families who sued the state. Well, since the McCleary ruling, Republicans and Democrats have been trying to do what the court said, and this year legislators say they have finally done it. They have fully funded basic education. Have they? Let's figure it out. My guests are Daniel Zavala from the League of Education Voters and Summer Stinson, a pro bono lawyer with a parents organization called Washington's Paramount Duty. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel, you say state lawmakers have fully funded basic education. What did they do?
So I can explain what they do, and I can kind of explain the caveat around having fully funded basic education.
Okay.
But in part, what they've done is make a historic investment in education. They've made significant moves towards structural equity by removing some policy barriers that were resulting in pretty significant inequities across the state that were realized across different districts in different ways. And with that, you know, additional investment around kind of moving towards fully funding basic education, the state has taken responsibility for teacher compensation for basic education services. And what we'll see in the next biennia, next two biennia, is $7.3 billion additional state funds towards education.
Okay, so $7.3 billion more dollars and reducing inequity across districts, which we're going to talk about. Summer, you don't think that lawmakers have satisfied the Supreme Court, right?
Correct.
Why
first
not?
First of all, the $7.3 billion is not all additional money.
Mm.
It is half of that money, or more than half, has just been transferred from our local levies that we all have already voted in and taken on by the state. So they've basically minimized McCleary. And so that $7.3 billion is over 4 years. And according to the state superintendent, $3 to $4 billion of that is just a pure transfer of funds from local levies to the state.
But that has to do with that inequity that Daniel was talking about, right?
Well, and that, no, because part of what McCleary is, it's not just an equity, it's also an adequacy, and it's more than adequacy, it's amply funding basic education. And that's the constitutional paramount duty of the state, is to amply fund basic education. The plaintiff's lawyer has put that as $5 billion a year in new money. For example, even the legislature has said that just fully funding the K-3 class size reduction, which is part of law and has been in law since 2009, is going to cost $1.15 billion this budget.
Well, the plaintiff's lawyer will ask for what they want, but what matters is the state Supreme Court justices,
well,
right? What
well,
makes
this
you think?
And this is the state. This is the state legislature has even said it's 1.15 this biennium, this budget, just to pay for a reduced class size reduction, which is K-3, which is still there. So basically, that absorbs a whole bunch of what is considered the money that's been put into McCleary, without even addressing then the teachers and the facilities and all the additional things that have been left unfunded by McCleary.
Okay, help us understand this then. Yes. Daniel, how is there, you're saying there is enough money there to fully fund education?
So what I'm actually saying, and I agree with Summer in that, you know, of the $7.3 billion that the legislature is talking about putting in new state funding, there are some portions of that that were already kind of dedicated. You know, we see about $2 billion of it that's about maintenance or carry forward, so kind of just keeping things operating as usual and keeping up with the additional costs of those things. But we are seeing additional investments into new areas that the state has not provided funding in before. And so in that, we do see that the staff compensation increases. We've seen the state over the last few years already make significant progress toward the K-3 class size reduction in providing additional funds for that purpose. And so when we talk about, you know, satisfying the Supreme Court and whether or not basic education was fully funded, two words that the Supreme Court used were that the funding streams were regular and dependable. And so we actually see that now, because when the reliance on local levies was in place, we saw that it could fluctuate from years, and it was really dependent on the districts and what they were able to do or willing to come up with. And so with the state taking responsibility there, we see a funding source and dedication toward basic education services that is both regular and dependable.
Okay, so the justices will weigh in on whether they think the state is funding education. You brought up this idea of local levies versus a statewide tax. Daniel, the big school districts in the Puget Sound area, Seattle, Bellevue, Lake Washington, and others, their property taxes are going up. Hundreds of dollars a year, right?
I'm not exactly sure what it would be okay. per district, but it would fluctuate depending on which district.
Why is that happening, basically?
So what the state has done is, you know, set a uniform marker around what would be collected for education. So we'll see $1.50 or $2,500 per student around local levies that is going to be capped. But then there's also going to be difference in the state property tax that's going to be collected. And I think that's what Summer was getting at in terms of the transfer of responsibility around what was collected at the local level is now going to be transferred somewhat to the state response.
Summer, what was the problem with collecting it at the local level?
Well, the state was not fully funding basic education, and so they were only paying a portion of what it actually costs school districts.
Why is that important, the question of where the money's coming from?
Because that's in our state's constitution. We're the only state in the entire country to state in our constitution that our paramount duty, the only time we mention paramount in our entire constitution, the paramount duty of our state is to amply fund basic education, which is public schools.
But is that a technicality, or is there something vital to our school children that the money come from the state and not local levies? What are we getting at that matters here?
What we're getting at is being able to give every child in the state, no matter where they live, and also no matter their circumstances, if they're an ELL learner, if they are a special education student, if they are a student of color, if they are an advanced learner, whatever their circumstances are, that they are going to get a basic education in our state.
So that wasn't happening enough. The system was too unfair from place to place and child to child.
Yes.
And is that going to happen now? Is there going to be equity?
Unfortunately not. And so one example I can give is that Seattle Public Schools pays out $60 million in special education funding per year. They have already figured out that under the new special education formula, which the legislature raised the cap, there's a spending cap on special education, which really shouldn't happen. It's our moral obligation and it is our legal obligation to pay for special education for children who need that. And unfortunately, the cap, while being raised, that is a good thing. The legislature also said is that local levy money can now no longer go towards special education. So they raised the cap less than 1%. But then they took away the ability of districts to use local levy money to help with special education. And so then the concern is what came out from the superintendent from Seattle Public Schools is the same thing with ELL as special education.
What is ELL?
English language learners, thank you. Mm-hmm. For special education, Seattle Public Schools pays out $60 million a year. The state's new formula will only reimburse them for $16 million a year. So that leaves a $44 million shortfall that they cannot now use local levies to help educate special education children. Then it means what the superintendent says is the same thing happened with English language learners and that funding and with transportation. And so now you're in a situation where a district like Seattle Public Schools is going to have to choose, how do they spend this money? Do they spend it on special education students? Do they spend it on English language learners? Do they spend it on transportation, getting kids to school? And those are impossible choices. And that's where it starts to then pit students against students and parents against parents in public school system, which we should not have, and is the actual, it's not equity.
Okay, is it equity, Daniel? What do you have a different picture of our school funding situation?
So I think it's a move towards structural equity. And I use those words carefully because we don't know what's going to result over the course of the next 4 years as this entire plan is kind of phased out. You know, and I say it's a move towards structural equity because we see the removal of some policy barriers like staff mix or other kind of staffing restrictions or funding allocations that resulted in inequity. And so as we kind of see those policies kind of fully realize the impact at the district level, we'll have a greater understanding. And so, you know, I agree with Summer in many regards around kind of the student supports and our students who have been historically underserved in recognizing that this very well may not be the final answer, right? We don't know quite yet, and we know that there is still continued work on that front in many regards.
Okay, so we're, as we said, this is going to go to the state Supreme Court. Lawmakers will present their plan to the Supreme Court in the next coming weeks. Summer mentioned that a big fix we still need is to remove this cap on special education spending. I want to give you the same chance, Daniel. What is the next big fix we need in the way we pay for schools, in your opinion?
It's a great question, and I'm sitting here trying to kind of rack my brain and think about what is kind of the most important thing as we move forward. And really, I think it aligns with what Summer was talking about around the student supports, around what we're doing to make sure that every student is getting the targeted resources they need and that those resources really do flow to the classroom.
Okay, so in coming weeks, lawmakers will say, here, State Supreme Court, this is what we've done, and it's up to the court to decide whether the plan fully funds education. And we don't really know if the court says we're to say no, then what? Then what does the court do? You know, in some places, there's been school shutdowns. There's been, right? Theoretically, the State Supreme Court should say, look, we're just going to make that money flow. We're going to turn off these tax exemptions and just bring more money into the schools. I mean, this is really a mystery in this state as to how this is going to work out. So that is coming in the coming weeks, and we'll follow that with you. We've been talking about this with Summer Stinson, who is vice president of Washington's Paramount Duty. That's a grassroots organization of parents advocating for the state to properly fund education. And Daniel Zavala is the director of policy and government relations with the League of Education Voters. Let's watch it together. Thanks to both of you.
Thank
you. Appreciate it.
And finally, one note on the state budget. When Governor Inslee signed the budget less than an hour before midnight on Friday, June 30th, that kept our state government from officially shutting down, a fate that New Jersey did not avoid. Their legislature didn't reach a budget. State offices have been closed all day today. State beaches were closed all weekend except for their governor, Chris Christie. One of his official residences is on a beach where he was photographed getting some sunshine with friends and family and nobody else because the beach was closed. And you'll hear about the fallout from that later this afternoon on KOW's All Things Considered. It's KOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Tomorrow, on the 4th of July, the Ballard Locks turn 100 years old. There'll be a parade there this Sunday recreating that day of triumph when commercial and pleasure boats first moved from the Saltwater Sound through the locks and the Ship Canal and on to freshwater Lake Washington. But triumph is not the whole story of the Ballard Locks. It's also a crushing story. Let's talk about this now with Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes. Linda, good to see you again.
Hi, Bill. It's great to be back.
So we're going to get to who this really affects. First, I just don't want to assume that everybody knows what the Ballard Locks are and how they came to be. What are the Ballard Locks?
So the Ballard Locks are our engineered connection to saltwater from the interior lakes of Seattle. So what we're talking about is Union Bay, Portage Bay, Lake Union, Salmon Bay out to Shoal Bay. This is an 8-mile-long corridor, and this connection allows mostly, by the way, pleasure boats to make the trip from freshwater to salt. And, you know, 81% of the vessel traffic today is recreational traffic. That was not the original idea. The idea was commerce. Open up this passage for shipping anything from logs to coal. And it was hoped there'd be a big industrial boom on the shores of Lake Washington.
Factories all along the canal?
Yeah, sure thing. That didn't happen. But, of course, creating this engineered channel and setting the lake levels by our control rather than nature allowed much of present-day Seattle's footprint to emerge. For instance, it used to be Lake Washington would drop and go up and down 7 feet during the course of the seasonal year. That doesn't happen anymore. We engineer the lake level today to only a 2-foot change. What does that mean? It means we have 2 floating bridges connecting us to the east side.
Well, if I guess you couldn't have floating bridges if the lake was rising and falling like that.
Makes you think about the future. What if we had a huge seismic event that were to take out the locks? Those bridges could not function. In fact, they would fail. Hmm. And so it's not like the Elwha Dam built out on the Olympic Peninsula in 1910, same time frame. You can't just take out the locks. So much of today's footprint of Seattle depends on the fact of this engineered channel and the presence of the locks. And of course, there's so much development in the shoreline that was created with the dropping of Lake Washington by 9 feet.
Yeah.
So this is, if you were to think of a single action that transformed Seattle, I can't think of anything that tops it. Even the filling of the tide flats at the Duwamish, even the regrade, those things went on for decades. With one action, we really created what is today the footprint of modern Seattle.
Yes. Let's talk about what went into that feat of engineering and the people it affected. Just describe what a feat of engineering that was.
Well, you know, it's pretty spectacular to consider this incredible reroute of the rivers of central Puget Sound, changing of the lake level, altering the hydrologic regime of the lake. Of course, it used to be low in the summer and high in the winter. Not anymore. We plump up the lake level for summer to have plenty of water for lockage. So that's a reversal. It used to be that salmon entered the Duwamish and went up the Black River to get to the south end of Lake Washington.
And the Black River, a river you may never have heard of.
Well, and this is a truly sad fact. So the Black River was a short, beautiful river and a salmon highway. So the salmon coming in the Duwamish cruised through the Black River to get to the high mountains, to the Cedar River, through Lake Washington, through its south end. The Black River used to be the southern drainage for the lake. When we dropped it 9 feet, that's a lot, that literally cut off, choked off, killed the Black River. And for the Duwamish people who were living along the Black River, longhouses all up and down there, all of a sudden, within 3 months, a place that had sustained them for 10,000 years just went away.
But that wasn't a surprise. Did the city consult with the people living and working along these waters?
Sadly not. So if you roll back in time, nobody was asking the native people, was this okay with them? Hardly. I mean, this is actually an even sadder story because this is after the treaty time. This is after the diseases, the dispossessions that had already been going on. And some of the Duwamish people had been pushed out of Seattle and taken up residence along the Black River as a kind of last stand. And then they lost even that. And similarly, in our coverage in the Sunday paper, we showed a picture of Salmon Bay Charlie hanging on in what is present-day Magnolia. He had
Salmon Bay Charlie is a real man.
He's an actual real person. Yeah. And we have a picture, which Mohai was kind enough to let us use, of him standing in his front yard with his clam basket over his arm as the three white guys show up to let him know it's time to go. You know, the timing of this story, of course, we brought it out now because of the anniversary, the centennial. But I think in Seattle right now, there are a lot of people feeling dispossessed, overrun by all the growth and all the change. I don't even know where my bank is anymore. I don't know where my anything is anymore. And I think to myself, you know, obviously this is nothing compared to what the first people of this place went through. This would be the equivalent of an alien force draining Elliott Bay, taking away all the grocery stores, and while you're at it, close the schools and the places of worship, because these were places of spirit power and instruction and sustenance for 10,000 years.
That's like an apocalypse when you put it that way.
That's the right word.
Yeah.
I wanted people to see the unseen and to make present the absence, to just pull back the frame historically and bring in images, people, places that actually are not gone. They're embedded in the landscape. They're a part of all of our history. And to stand there on the shore of Lake Union, for instance, with Warren King George, historian for the Muckleshoot Tribe, and ask him to look at this same place with me as the seaplane is buzzing overhead and the tourists are kayaking by, this place where we'll all watch fireworks in a couple of days. And he would point and say, that's the place where it was good to put in canoes because it was nice and deep. That's the place where a cougar hopped over the logs to avoid his competitors. That's the place where it was good to gather the cattails for weaving tule mats. You know, that wasn't very long ago. Out here in the Northwest, history is so recent, and it's in some cases hidden in plain sight. And it's good to seek out this history, know this history. And so to go to these places with descendants of the ancestors who went through this apocalyptic change was a rich and evocative privilege, really.
You mentioned that, and the way you said it, that this is mostly pleasure boats that are coming through the locks, not commerce as was the original plan. Is there something wrong with that?
Well, there's an issue, which is funding. Because of the way the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which built, manages, runs the locks, charges for those services, they only charge for commercial tonnage. This means even the fishing boats that come through the locks to snug in, they've already offloaded their catch. They're not paying. The pleasure boats aren't paying. This means the locks are drastically underfunded. This is an unresolved issue. And as we think about the locks in 100 years, there are a couple of things that have got to get figured out. One of them is funding to take care of the locks so that they don't fall apart, and also to improve salmon passage as best as possible in a completely altered system. But you know, another thing to talk about is water. So here we are using first use, beautiful mountain water from the Cedar River watershed every time boats want to go through. In the scenario of climate change, is that something we're going to be able to do? Should we at least be charging? Seismic retrofit, how safe are the locks in the event of a dramatic earthquake? That's something to think about. And so there are sustainability issues with regard to the locks in addition to the environmental justice issues that we raised in our story.
Okay, so I wonder, though, if I read you wrong, if I read your face wrong, when you said that this is mostly pleasure boats going through, and you describe how that could be a funding issue, but is there some kind of moral failing around... I'm getting that from you, you know? What's
yes.
What's the ethical issue that I feel you have with this being a recreational, fun thing to do, to traverse this?
Let me take you along with me as I'm standing at the Ballard Locks with Warren King George a couple of days ago. Hundreds and hundreds of tourists milling around, enjoying themselves. It's summer, you know, going down to watch the sockeye struggle through the fish ladder. They're having a great time. I mean, it's pretty entertaining, right? You've got these boats to watch, the fish to go see. You go back and forth the two sides. It's a jolly, fun place to be. You've got the tour boats coming through. You know, here's Warren King George's perspective. He's a Muckleshoot tribal member, and he said he used to be a fish counter at the locks for his tribe for 5 years. And he said, you know, I used to watch what we call shake and bakes, where the sea lions are shredding the adult salmon and the seagulls are eating the juveniles. He said, to us, those are our relatives. Those are our fish. And it was just horrible to watch. And he said there'd be days when he would talk to people and interact, and there'd be other days where really he just didn't want to say a word. It's just too hard to watch this gaiety, if you will, this circus that to him is a place of horrendous displacement and loss. And, you know, his point about the recreational traffic is, and for what? You know, it's not like, say, Grand Coulee Dam or the Columbia River dams, where at least you have power generation for an entire region and beyond, all the way to the Western grid. I mean, in this case, what we wound up with is something a lot of people value, but recreational boat traffic, it wasn't the only way we could have that. And so to Warren King George and other Native people and even the rest of us, it's something to think about. You know, it's a lot was lost, an entire river, the migratory route of the native fish of this place, village sites, longhouses, sacred places, places of important spirit power. That's a lot.
it's a lot to wrestle with. For one thing, there's this, we have this, now it's become a caricature of an indigenous way of life before white settlement, that it was a life of subsistence and we don't think of indigenous people as having changed their environment, which is never really true, right? You're nodding. You can still see the fishing weirs, you know, right, in Lake Washington. We've always changed things. Humans have changed things to our liking.
Sure. Native people burned the prairies to keep the camas fresh and keep back the tree cover. They used fish weirs to trap fish. Technology was always part and is still part of their life ways. And so, sure, people get oversimplified and drawn in black and white. There was a lot more going on than those caricatures reveal. But I think the other thing that really struck me in the reporting for this story was the presence, not the absence, the presence of Native people in this place today and the vividness of the connection. And by the way, the thriving presence of those people. Talking with Leonard Forsman of the Suquamish tribe, he's the chairman for the tribe, and he spoke beautifully, I thought, of how on certain days, if the light is just right, you know, you look across Elliott Bay and the urban waters and you can see the stories and the wisdom of his ancestors. You look at the Suquamish tribe today and, you know, they have their own language program, their own culture program, their own school, their economy is doing well and diversifying. Look at the Muckleshoot tribe, diversifying, thriving in a modern world, in a context that they have created with the benefit of treaty rights reserved by their ancestors, knowing that they would need a way to hang on in what was a new world. You look at the Duwamish people, not even recognized by the federal government. So the story isn't the same story. What is true is the persistence of Native people in this place in their own way. And I think that, for instance, going to the locks with Ken Workman from the Duwamish tribe, to hear him talk about feeling the presence, literally, physically, of his ancestors, their DNA, 10,000 years of burials still in the soil, he meant that. And watching his face, I know that he felt that.
Yeah, I've talked to tribal members who try to help me understand that this is not a matter of history to them, right? That industrialization and straightened concrete rivers and all that's just a blip.
Correct.
In the bigger story.
If you think about time, and you were to stretch a string across this room that we're sitting in, all the way from one side to the other, 15-foot long room, our presence, yours and mine, it would be the last little frayed end. We're tiny, we are a blip, and there was so much that came before, and there'll be so much more to this story. I think that it's really helpful to me, anyway, as I think about where we are now in time in the Pacific Northwest, to always seek to pull back the frame and see the bigger picture.
So what's the lesson? Should Seattle not have built the Ballard Locks?
I love that question.
You love-hate that question?
Yeah. I mean, if you're on the east side and you love zipping over to Seattle on a bridge rather than having to take the Mosquito fleet, you know, probably you're going to enjoy that overflight by the F-15 fighter jets, you know, tomorrow celebrating the locks. If you're Ken, if you're Warren, if you're some of the other people that I talked to for this story, if you're Leonard, you know, not so much. I talked to the vice chairman of the Suquamish tribe, and he's been a fisherman all his life, and here's what he said. I wish they were gone.
By the way, why did the industrial boom on the shores of Lake Washington not materialize?
It's funny. The mills just didn't move from Ballard, you know, present-day Ballard. I guess I don't know why that didn't happen. You know, you'd think, build it, they'll come. Somehow that just didn't happen. I mean, obviously we've got tons of development, but it's mostly residential today.
Are you going to tomorrow's commemoration?
I am not.
No? You won't see the Navy Boeing fighter jet fly over? You know why that is? Apparently that during the original opening ceremony, July 4th, 1917, a Boeing biplane circled overhead.
Well, there you go. Full circle. Yeah. I wonder what they'll do for the next 100.
But you won't be there.
I will not.
What do you, when you look at the Ballard Locks, what do you think about?
Well, I'll tell you, for me, this is an unfolding story. I've been visiting the locks as a reporter and a resident of Seattle since 1992. And each time I've gone there, it's as a reporter, it's been for a salmon story, you know, about the sockeye run, which we actually planted there in 1935 just for fun. And actually, it is cool to be able to see the fish up close like that through a window. We don't usually get to see that. You know, as a reporter, for me, it's always been a fish story. This was the first time I was able to engage the human story of that place. And I learned so much, and it was really a privilege to understand where I was standing and what was there not long ago. And to understand that where there are condos today, those are burial sites. To think about the Black River, just to go back to that for a moment, the Black River today is a small wetland reserve. It's about 52 acres. It is surrounded by 405, a road that's actually called Monster Road. I'm not making this up. And the South Sewage Treatment Plant for King County. And yet it abides as a little wet spot. It in times is the largest heron rookery in our region. So even today, it is a place of richness. And I find that instructive. You know, nature is the most powerful force and never wholly annihilated. Even now, you know, you look at the locks and Chinook salmon, they're now listed as a threatened species. You have this very sad situation where the endangered orcas are trying to make their meals out of threatened Chinook salmon, an endangered species barely surviving, starving because they need a threatened species. And yet, Puget Sound Chinook do abide. They are still here. The sockeye, there hasn't been a sockeye fishery since 2006. The sport fishermen grieve the loss of salmon, as do the tribal fishermen. You know, we haven't had a sport fishery for Chinook in Elliott Bay in 10 years. So this is a landscape that is very challenged at this point to support the native wildlife that depends on it. And I think, you know, that's a lesson for us. It's something for us to think about, the costs and the benefits.
Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes, are you going to the parade on Sunday?
I am not.
Okay. She'll be missing the historic schooner passing through the locks and leading a parade of historic vessels from Salmon Bay to Lake Union. But you're not against taking your kids or your out-of-town friend to the fish ladder?
Of course not. I mean, if anything, I would love to see more interpretive signage at the locks. A lot of people don't go into the visitor center, as cool as it is. There should, in my view, be much more about the native presence that was displaced, about the native wildlife that have been displaced and are struggling. This is the sort of thing that the Friends of the Ballard Locks and the Army Corps of Engineers, to their credit, have worked hard on. But I would like to see even more because so many people go there. It is the third most popular tourist stop in Seattle, 1.3 million people a year. That's a lot of education that could be enriched. So I'd like to see that. I think it's always great for people to go outside and see the landscape. I'm for that.
Space Needle, Pike Place Market, Ballard Locks. One of them has an amazing, as we said, triumphant / crushing story to it.
Yes.
And you can read Linda's piece about the 100 years of the Ballard Locks in the Seattle Times. We'll tweet that out now at KUOW. And you're doing a Facebook Live event on Thursday?
Right. So go on the Seattle Times Facebook page, and that'll be at noon. Bring your questions, rants, raves, whatever you'd like to bring up.
Linda Mapes, Seattle Times environment reporter. It's always good to see and hear you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
KUOW's The Record coming right back. Now, across the water from Seattle, you have a beautiful town called Bremerton with a lot of things going for it, lovely views and relatively affordable homes, and beginning next week, a fast ferry. One thing Bremerton doesn't have so much is a strong network of neighborhood groups. Seattle is famous for its strong neighborhood groups, the kind that speak up for their neighborhood's needs, and they can fight back against the coming gentrification. Well, Maria Vila would like to change that situation. She co-chairs a group called Neighborhoods Now in Bremerton. And Vila says part of the reason neighborhoods haven't organized before now is that Bremerton was depressed economically.
Bremerton has had a long history of huge boom times, but then, gosh, since the 60s, Bremerton has been in a semi-depressed, blighted, and poverty-stricken period. And it's been really hard. There's been, you know, a flee of businesses out of the city in the 70s, in the 80s. So it's just been decades of struggling to try to get back to those years when there was a strong economy and there was a little bit more money and a little bit more community, maybe, or.
But what's the connection? Why do you go to community? Why would an economic decline hurt community in Bremerton?
So it's not that there's a lack of community. There's a lack of community organization, I guess.
Help me understand that.
So my experience with outreach to the Bremerton community was from when I worked primarily with the Bremerton Block Grant Program. And I don't know if this is helpful, but part of my job was to reach out to people and get feedback and get input. What is it that we can do with this money that the federal government is giving us that can help you? And I'd get a lot of input from agencies, but it was really hard to get people to step up and speak up and interact. So that's mostly where my experience comes from.
Are you saying that Bremerton has had it tough economically and that can make people feel dispossessed and left out and not wanting to participate?
Not that they don't want to, but yes, I believe that it can make people feel disempowered. Absolutely.
And when people feel disempowered, how does that play out within their neighborhoods?
There hasn't really been a neighborhood movement to relate this to, I guess,
okay,
at this point. But I think the same thing has happened in Seattle. When you have neighborhood associations, you do get folks that feel empowered, generally middle class folks, and they are ready to let the world know what they feel and what they need. And a lot of people hang back. Some because they're shy, but a lot of people because they don't feel like they're the ones that are being called upon. So I guess with Neighborhoods Now, we're calling upon everyone, really everyone. So I think we do have to make a very concerted effort to make this inclusive. We have to reach out very specifically to the groups that aren't coming forward. And it could be our minorities. It could be folks that speak a different language primarily in their households, and probably the very low income community. We'll have to reach out to on purpose and make sure that those groups are brought in.
If people in Bremerton were more active in their neighborhoods, what would they be doing? Be specific.
Yeah, you know, I think it really boils down to super simple things. We're talking about potlucks. I'm talking about going for a walk with your neighbor. Creating those simple connections. It's not political. It's not activism. It's not organizing. It's none of those things that may put people off. It's like the super basic common denominator amongst people in a community is enjoying the people that live nearby. So right now we're trying to encourage folks to just have a potluck, have a neighborhood picnic in somebody's backyard, you know, invite the 20 houses all around you or your block or your cul-de-sac and just have a super simple, cheap and easy crappy dinner party.
I'm a big believer in that.
Yeah.
Relaxes everybody and you're more likely to do it.
You're likely to do it if you don't have to plan it to pieces.
Yes.
Yeah. So just bringing people together. That's how it starts. And then from there, each neighborhood can figure out, well, who are we and where are we? What is our neighborhood? What do we value? each neighborhood's going to be a little bit different. Some are going to be a little more quirky. Some are going to have more kids. Some are going to be older. They're all going to have different needs and interests, and they'll be able to really develop those on their own. The Bremerton Neighborhoods Now would then be the tool, kind of the umbrella organization, to help them where they need some support. A little bit of money, hopefully, in the future with matching grants. Technical support, you know, if there's something they want to do and they don't quite know how to do it, being that liaison maybe with the city, or, you know, we'll see where it goes. But that's kind of the role that we're seeing Neighborhoods Now would be in, and that to really encourage these neighborhood groups to form and provide the support where needed.
The mayor of Bremerton, Patty Lent, is advocating for Seattleites to move to Bremerton. What happens if Seattle transplants become part of Neighborhoods Now, your group, and they start getting traction from the city government for what they want and leave renters and other Bremertonians behind?
Well, I would hope that city government recognizes that people coming in have a great, also have great assets that they're bringing, and that the people coming into Bremerton understand that Bremerton is Bremerton, and it's a little gritty, and it's a super cool place, but it's not Seattle, and they should embrace it for what it is. And one of the things that myself and the community group, the neighbors that I've been meeting with, are interested in making sure that we are proactive and positive in making sure that we embrace change, but make it clear what change looks like to us, what we want to see our neighborhoods and community become, and not just become a place for real estate prospecting, because we're much more than cheap housing and pretty neighborhoods with opportunity and potential. We're a lot more than a good housing market for the region. We are neighborhoods, we're a community, we're a lot of other things. So
that neighborhood is organized, it's got group confidence, and it's not just going to get pushed around because nobody, right. There's not a voice.
Exactly. So I think right now Bremerton feels like it is the time for this kind of work with neighborhoods.
And that's because Bremerton is booming or about to boom, and there's going to be a lot of...
I think there's a sense that things are moving.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it is time.
Marie Vila, Bremerton resident for 13 years now and co-founder of the Bremerton group Neighborhoods Now. Thank you for this.
Thank you, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The myth is if you own a Washington State marijuana shop, you can make millions. The fact is you probably won't. The reasons for that are in a new report in the Puget Sound Business Journal, and the editor-in-chief is Emily Parkhurst. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
You report that it's hard to be a marijuana retailer. Why is that?
You know, I think it's there's a lot of different reasons. And, you know, when you think about it, you see a lot of marijuana shops around town. I think people are assuming that there's a lot of money to be made in marijuana, and that may be true eventually, but it's not really true right now. We're seeing a lot of these marijuana retail shops and the companies that are making things like edibles really struggling to survive. And it's partially due to the enormous tax burden that's on top of these businesses, you know, and I think a lot of the folks who got into it knew that there would be a tax burden, but it's turned out to be a little bit more than I think a lot of companies were expecting.
Why? What's that tax burden like in Washington State?
Sure. Well, it's multiple taxes from multiple different angles. So if you look at, you know, just the tax for marijuana is 37% on top of the sales tax. So that's a pretty high sales tax. But then if you take into account the state already has a fairly high taxes for operating a business, like the business and occupation tax, the B&O tax that all businesses pay. And then if you also take into account that because of a federal law, these marijuana businesses are not allowed to write off any of their expenses. So a normal business would be able to write off a lot of their expenses. You know, they'd be able to write off their physical space, you know, how much they're paying to lease that space, that kind of thing, any office supplies. The marijuana companies, because of a federal law, can't write that off against their federal taxes. So there's a fairly significant tax burden for these businesses.
Why is that? Why, beyond the state sales tax, why is there a big marijuana industry tax burden?
Well,
besides,
you know,
federal government, but in Washington State.
Well, in Washington State, one of the reasons that we were able to pass this is because it's a huge revenue generation machine for the state, and the state has grown quite fond of that tax, and it's a 37% tax on all marijuana products. That's brought in about $550 million in excise taxes since it was passed. So that's a big chunk of change going to the state. And that was, you know, the bargaining chip, basically, for legalization of recreational marijuana, is that it's going to fund, you know, and a lot of that money's going toward education. And as we can see, that has paid off.
Okay, well, I want to talk about a couple other burdens on retailers and then talk about whether it's all worth it, whether the burdens are a good idea. First of all, are there too many pot shops and there needs to be a shakeout?
You know, I think if you're walking around Seattle, that might be the impression that you have. There's certainly a lot of them in Seattle. We did a list of the top 25 marijuana retailers in the state, and only two of them are in Seattle. So what that tells us is that, you know, the largest recreational marijuana shops, you know, are in cities where there are fewer recreational marijuana shops. And that makes a certain amount of sense. So I think you do see quite a bit of competition in the city of Seattle. But as soon as you leave the city, there's far fewer. And there are whole cities that have that don't allow marijuana shops at all. So the shops around those areas are doing quite well. And then we've seen things like in Vancouver, the marijuana shops down there did very well in the first couple of years, but then when Oregon legalized marijuana, their sales have plummeted.
Right. Okay. You also say there's a problem with constantly changing marijuana regulations. What do you mean? How do they change?
You know, I think most of the folks who got involved in the marijuana industry early on knew that there were going to be changes to the law as we kind of figured out as a state and as a community, you know, how we wanted to regulate this. But what has happened is that a lot of these changes, they're implemented incredibly quickly. So that means that these businesses have, you know, a lot of cases only 60 days to comply with major changes to the law. The example I'll give is, you know, the state made some changes to the way that edible marijuana products need to be labeled. Well, those packages that edible marijuana comes in, they're supposed to be child safe, and so they're very difficult to open, and they're also very expensive to produce. The state didn't give the marijuana shops much time to comply with that, and some of the folks who were making edibles had to throw away tens of thousands of dollars worth of very expensive packaging and start over again. And when you're talking about a business that's already operating really close to the margin, that can be enough to push them over the brink.
Okay, so it can be hard to sell marijuana compared to selling books and shoes and glassy babies. But, Emily, this is a federally illegal, mind-altering substance with dimly understood health effects. Are you sure that a little burden isn't a good thing?
You know, I think that there's a lot to be said for that, Bill. You know, there's a reason that it's going to be heavily regulated. I think the thing that Washington State needs to balance, though, is this understanding that a lot of other states are now legalizing recreational marijuana, and it's only a matter of time before it's federally legal, we believe. And so if the state wants to be the place where, you know, some of these big brands grow up and become, you know, major employers for this area, then we need to look at our competition. And our competition is going to be states like Massachusetts, like Oregon, where, you know, folks can maybe get a business off the ground a little bit easier, get itself established in these early days, and then turn into a billion-dollar business down the road when it's legalized. And we want to be the place where that happens, because that means jobs, that means, you know, a lot more tax revenue for Washington State, and Washington State could use that.
Just a minute left or so then, Emily. As you said, at least in Seattle, there are plenty of pot shops, less so in other places, but you've described some of the difficulties that the state is putting in the way of would-be marijuana sellers. Do you think there's going to be a shakeout? Are we in a marijuana bubble?
In a marijuana bubble. I don't know about a bubble. I do think that we are going to see some marijuana shops and some marijuana, maybe not the growers, but particularly the edibles businesses, things like that, go away in the next couple of years. This is a really tough business right now. There are a lot of people who are really interested in being part of it. They're excited about legalization. They want to be part of this new industry. And the folks that survive are going to do very well. But this is going to, I think, be a rough couple of years. And the growth that we've seen was 200% revenue growth the first year. It's now down to about 69% growth. We're going to continue to see that growth slow. And as it continues to slow, we're going to see some businesses go away.
Emily Parkhurst, editor-in-chief at the Puget Sound Business Journal. The piece in the journal describes the barriers, the struggles to make it in the marijuana industry here in the early days in Washington. We're tweeting out a link to that right now at KUOW. Emily, thank you.
Hey, thank you.
KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Thanks for tuning in.